lightning forked. Odo Chocker, the chief steward, served as head butler, supervising the three maids, Lily, Myra and Tanya, as they brought course after course to the table. Chocker was 7 feet tall, with broad shoulders, only now bowed by years. He had been the captain of the Udolpho Guard during the last major family war, when old Melmoth's now-dead necromancer brother, Otranto, had raised demons and the dead in an onslaught upon the estates. Chocker had sustained wounds from a Slaaneshi demon's claw that carved 3 deep grooves diagonally across his face, twisting his nose, tearing his lips, and making his eyes seem to stare through the dead skin bars of a cage mask. His voice had been torn from him, but he was still a capable man, and old Melmoth trusted him more even than Vatek and Valdemar. No one doubted that Chocker stood to benefit from the will. Genevieve didn't want to eat. Her meat was overcooked, grey through to the heart, and she didn't care for vegetables, particularly the black-eyed, grey-white potatoes produced by the estate's garden. She took a little red wine, ignoring Flaminea's dagger looks, but it only served to sting her palate. She thirsted, but not for wine, and she hungered, but not for cooked-through beef. The meal was mainly eaten without conversation. The clatter of knives and forks on plates was backgrounded by driving rain and the constant crescendo of thunder. The storm excited Genevieve, aroused in her a hunting instinct. She wanted to be outside, slaking her thirst. The maids took away her uneaten main course, and there was a pause. Chocker signalled, and new bottles of wine were presented to Shedoni for his approval. He blew dust off a label, coughed, and nodded.
"I hardly think innocent children should be exposed to such vice and debauchery, father," snapped Flaminea, thin lips pinching as she enthusiastically chewed her morsels of meat. "We do not want to raise another generation of sybarites and libertines."
Flora and young Melmoth looked at each other and smiled. Their teeth were tiny and sharp, their eyes nearly almond-shaped. Genevieve had seen them playing games with the castle cats and could not think of them as innocents. She sipped her wine.
"You see," Flaminea said, "my niece is on the slope to degradation already, swilling wine at her tender years, wearing silks and satins to inflame the lusts of vile men, combing out her long golden hair. The rot has started. You can't see it yet, but it will show on her face before long. Another 16 years and her face will be as corrupted and monstrous as—"
There was a loud thunderclap, and Flaminea refrained from naming the name. Shedoni stared her down, and she collapsed in her seat, shut up by her father's glance. Genevieve had heard her grandmother was hideously disfigured by disease, and that she was always veiled as she grovelled in her rooms, awaiting Moore's last kiss. Genevieve raised her goblet in a toast to her aunt and drained it. The wine was as tasteless and unsustaining as rainwater. Ambrosio had shown some interest when the subject of inflamed lusts was raised, and his swollen, purple-veined face wobbled as he licked his lips, his hand under the table fastening upon the upper thigh of Lily, the maid pouring his wine. A smile spread over his features as he reached higher, and Lily betrayed no sign of the attentions he was paying to her. A thin string of drool dangled from the cleric's mouth. He wiped it away with a finger. Shedoni drank and surveyed the family and its retainers. His face was the template from which everyone else around the table, even the beautiful Christabel, seemed to have been struck. But before Shedoni, the long nose and deep eyes had belonged to old Melmoth, and before old Melmoth, there were generations of the House of Udolpho, all the way back to Smara's father, the Black Signet. There was a portrait of the pirate, standing aboard the deck of his vessel, supervising the execution of an Araby captain, and he too bore the Udolpho features. He must have been the originator of the line, Genevieve realised. Before the pirate, There had been no family. It was his stolen fortune that had created the house. Ravaglioli and Pintaldi were arguing quietly, their old quarrel revived again, and making threatening gestures with their dinner knives. Once, Pintaldi had ended an argument by thrusting a skewer into Ravaglioli's throat between the meat course and the game, and then, with a flourish, taken his soup spoon to the other man's eyes. Ravaglioli had not forgotten or forgiven that.
"After dinner, I shall play the harpsichord," Christabel announced.
She was not contradicted. Genevieve's cousin had learned music in Nuln and possessed a pleasant, although not outstanding, voice. At the academy, she had also begun to get the measure of her own charms and was clearly more than a little frustrated to be removed from the society of the Empire back to Udolpho, where her opportunities for breaking hearts were severely limited. Since she had driven Praz, the gamekeeper, to suicide, there had been no one to torment with her sable-black hair, liquid eyes, and silky skin. She spent much of her time wandering the broken battlements of Udolpho, fretting and plotting, shroud-like dresses flapping in the breeze, petting the ravens.
In Nuln, my playing was often praised by the Countess Emmanuel von Li.
Christabel's boast was interrupted by thunder and lightning, and another crash of noise. At once it was colder and wetter. Everyone in the great hall turned to the floor-to-ceiling windows, which had just been blown in. Rain was pouring into the hall like shot, and stung on Genevieve's face. The wind screamed as the candles placed down the spine of the table guttered and went out. Chairs were pushed noisily back. Flaminea gave a polite little squeak of fright, and hands went to sword hilts. It was dark, but Genevieve could make everyone out. Her eyes were fine at night. She saw Chocca moving slowly, as if in a dream, across the hall, reaching for a lantern. One of the maids was wrestling with the opened windows, forcing them shut. The wind and the rain were shut off, and the light came up again as Chocca turned up the wick of the lantern. There were strangers, dripping wet, standing behind Shadoni's huge chair. While the windows were open, someone had come into the hall. Chapter 6. The company was gloomy, with funereal clothes and long faces, and their great hall was ill-lit and dusty, the upper walls covered with filth and cobweb. Some of the diners looked barely alive, and they all had an unhealthy pallor, as if they'd lived all their lives in these shadows, never emerging into the sunlight. There were two pretty girls among them, though, a pale, lithe blonde and a lush, dark-haired beauty. They immediately excited Klejowski's revolutionary interest. Trapped, like Olympia and Julieta, by the conventions of their class, they might make enthusiastic converts to the cause.
"We were lost," he explained. "We made for your light."
Nobody said anything. They all looked hungrily at the newcomers.
"There's a storm outside," said Antonia, unnecessarily. "The road is washing away." "They can't stay," said a thin old woman, voice cracking with meanness. "Outsiders can't stay."
Klejowski didn't like the sound of that.
"We've nowhere else to go. There's no passable road."
"It would be against his will,"
the woman said, looking up at the shadowed ceiling.
"Old Melmoth can't abide outsiders."
They all thought about that, looking at each other. There was an ancient man, a halo of cotton-spun white hair fringing his skull, at the head of the table. Klejowski took him to be in charge, although he didn't seem to be this old Melmoth. By his side stood a tall, scar-faced servant, the muscle of the family, typical of the type that leaves their own class and helps the aristocracy keep his brothers and sisters in chains. A dangerous brute, to judge by the height and breadth of him and the size of his hairy-backed hands. Still, his face showed he had, at least once in life, taken second prize in a fight.
"Shh, Flaminea," the old man told the woman. "We've no choice."
Several men of the company had swords out, as if expecting banditti or beastmen. Klosowski noticed a pronounced family resemblance. Long noses, hollow eyes, distinct cheekbones. He was reminded of the phantom face in the blue light, and wondered whether perhaps they wouldn't be better off taking their chances with the storm.
"See here," said D'Amato, who seemed to inflate as he dried. "You'll have to shelter us. I'm an important man in Miragliano. Isidro D'Amato. Ask anyone and they'll tell you. You'll be well rewarded."
The old man looked at D'Amato with contempt.
"I doubt if you could reward us, signor."
"Ha!" D'Amato said. "I'm not without wealth."
"I am Schedoni Udolpho," the old man said. "The son of Melmoth Udolpho. This is a rich estate, weighed down with wealth beyond your imagination. You can have nothing we could want."
D'Amato stepped back towards a fireplace the size of a stable where whole trees burned and looked away. He seemed smaller with the fire behind him, and he was still clinging to his bag as if it contained his beating heart. With typical bourgeois sliminess, he'd been impressed by talk of wealth beyond your imagination. Klosowski remembered where he'd heard of D'Amato. Miragliano, a seaport built on a network of islands in a salt marsh, was a rich trading city, but it suffered from a lack of drinkable water. Fortunes had been made via water caravans and canals, and D'Amato had been the leading water merchant in the city, carving out his own empire, forcing his competitors out of business. A year or so ago, he had achieved an almost total control over the city's fresh water and been able to treble the price. The city fathers had protested, but had to give in and pay him. He had been a powerful man indeed. But then the yellow ague had come, and investigating scryers laid the blame on contaminated water. That explained why D'Amato was leaving home. Schedoni signalled to the scarred hulk.
"Giocca," he said. "Bring more chairs and mulled wine. Our guests are in danger of catching their deaths."
Klosowski had stepped as close to the fire as he could and felt his clothes drying on him. Antonia had stripped her soaked shawl and was raising thin skirts to toast her legs. Klosowski noticed that at least one of the Udolpho clan was especially intrigued by the spectacle. The flabby old fellow with a cleric's skullcap and a lecher's look in his eye. Antonia laughed gaily and did a few dance steps.
"I'm a dancer sometimes," she said, "not a very good one."
Her legs were shapely, with a dancer's muscles.
"I used to be an actress too, murdered by the end of Act One."
She stuck her tongue out and hung her neck as if it were broken. Her blouse was soaked to her skin, leaving Klosowski in no doubt as to her qualifications for the entertainment business. D'Amato swarmed around Antonia, making her drop her wet skirts to cover herself.
"Sorry," she said. "Bought and paid for, that's me. The water wizard has exclusive rights to all performances."
She was remarkably cheerful, and D'Amato was obviously embarrassed by his plaything's boldness.
"Harlotry is the path to chaos and damnation," said the shrivelled killjoy. "This house was always plagued with harlots and loose women, with their painted cheeks and their sinful laughter. But they're all dead now, and I, righteous and ridiculous Flaminea, am still here. They used to laugh at me when I was a girl, and ask me if I was saving my body for the worms. But I'm alive, and they're not."
Klosowski had Flaminea marked as a cheerless maniac straight away. She seemed to derive considerable enjoyment from contemplating the deaths of others, so she wasn't denying herself every earthly pleasure. The Hulk found him a place at the table, next to a moustached gallant who couldn't hold his head properly.
I'm Pentaldi,
the young man said. Alexander, Klejowski returned. Pentaldi reached for a candle and brought it close. Klejowski felt the heat on his face.
Fascinating stuff, Flame, he said. I've made a study of it. They're all wrong, you know. It's not hot, it's cold. And flames are pure like sharp knives. They consume the evil and leave the good. Flames are the fingers of the gods.
Very interesting, said Klejowski, taking a swallow of the wine Chocker had decanted for him. It stung his throat and warmed his belly. Flaminea glared at him, as if he were molesting a child in her presence.
You are a cleric of Moor,
said a hairy-faced beast sat near old Melmoth.
What are you doing out in the storm?
Klejowski was befuddled for a moment, then remembered his borrowed robe. Death is everywhere, he said, holding up his stolen amulet.
The dead are everywhere, said the hairy man, especially here. Why, in this very hall, the ghostly disembodied hands of the strangling steward frequently take shape and fix about the throats of unwary guests.
D'Amato coughed and spat out his wine. Only those guilty of some grave crime need fear the strangling steward, said the folklorist. He only visits the guilty.
My apologies, said Schedoni. We are an old family, and our blood has grown thin. Isolation has made us eccentric. You must think us strange company.
Everyone looked at Klejowski, hollow eyes seeming to glow blue in the gloom.
Oh, no, he said. You've been most hospitable. This certainly compares favourably with the last noble house in which I was a guest.
That much was true, although Klejowski suspected Chocker might share certain talents with Tancredi. All these aristocratic menages kept a pet killer.
You must stay the night, Schedoni said. The house is large, and rooms can be found for you.
Klejowski wondered how long he could maintain the deception. Since the great fog riots, his name had been a byword for insurrection. If he were to be revealed to the Udolpho clan as Prince Klejowski, the revolutionist poet, he'd probably find himself defenestrated. And the far windows of the great hall overlooked the gorge below. It would be a fall of 700 or 800 feet onto jagged rocks. Pentaldi had picked up the candelabrum now and was holding his palm close to a flame.
See, he said, it burns cold.
His skin was blackening, and there was a nasty, meaty smell.
Harlots will rot, said Flaminea.
Klejowski looked across the table at the fair young girl. She had sat, quietly, saying nothing, her eyes demurely cast down. She didn't have the Udolpho look, yet she was obviously part of this bizarre collection. Her lips were unrouged, but deep red, and she had white, sharp teeth. She looked up and caught his gaze. She seemed about 16, but her clear eyes were ancient.
Without harlots, where'd be the fun in the world? Said Antonia.
Flaminea shook a bony fist at the dancer and spat a chunk of gristle onto her plate. The woman had a fuzz of beard on her chin, and her hair was scraggy grey. Dried out, Antonia was as healthy as a ripe apple, and made a distinct contrast with this withered crew.
I shall play the harpsichord, said the dark girl sitting by the fat cleric.
Schedoni nodded, and the girl got up, daintily walking across the hall to the instrument. She wore something long, black and clinging, like a stylish shroud. Klejowski was feeling warm again, but somehow the cold was settled in his bones. Chapter 7. As Christabel played, Genevieve considered the outsiders. Something about them disturbed her. She saw Ambrosio's lips tighten as Antonia showed her legs. She felt the strange hostility between the cleric of Moor and the merchant of Miragliano. These men hadn't chosen to travel together, and both had things to hide. She imagined travelling, coaches crossing the old world, from Istalia to Britonia, from the Empire to Kislev. There were great cities, Paravon, Altdorf, Marienburg, Erengrad, Zufbar, and unknown far-distant countries, Cathay, Lustria, Nippon, the Darklands. She believed she had spent all her life at Udolpho, never leaving its walls, as much a prisoner as invalid Matilda, or the altered son Ravaglioli and Flamineo were rumoured to have penned in a cellar, fed only on human flesh. All she could remember was Udolpho, and she couldn't even remember much of that. There were huge gaps in her recollection, and yet impressions of things she could never have known sometimes came to her. Christabel played strangely, letting her juice dreams seep through as she embroidered around the edges of a familiar piece. Her tangle of black hair flew back as she nodded her head in time to the savage music. The music disturbed Genevieve Moore. In her mind, she was a predator, tearing out the throats of her prey, her teeth sinking into flesh, delicious blood gushing into her mouth, trickling over her chin, flowing over her bosom. Her nails had become sharp, and her teeth shifted in her mouth, the enamel reshaping. There were other dream memories crowding in. Faces, names, places, events. Things she could never have known she experienced. She remembered a crowd attacked by invisible forces, and the kiss of a dark, handsome man who had changed her. She remembered a queenly woman, her face and arms red with blood, dressed in the costume of an earlier age. She remembered an iron bracelet and a chain, tying her to a rough-faced man, and a night in an inn. She remembered twice venturing into a castle to face a great enchanter. She remembered a theatre and a striking actor and her flight from him, from his city. She remembered a thing with the body of a sea creature and the eyes of a man. All these things were more than dreams, and yet they did not fit with the life Genevieve knew she had lived, a quiet, secluded, forgotten life in this castle. Christabel's shoulders heaved, and sweat fell from her face. Flaminea grunted from time to time. Music was sinful in her mind, and she rejected her daughter's talent. Sometimes Christabel killed her mother, choking the life out of her with a silken scarf, or battering her with a stone torn out of the walls of the house. Sometimes, when Flaminea worked up a righteous frenzy, it was the other way around, and she would denounce her daughter as a witch, standing by smugly while the villagers dragged her to the stake and Pintaldi lovingly nurtured the bonfire. The cleric of Moor was looking at her. He was a foreigner and didn't strike her as being a real cleric. Even Ambrosio had something about him that suggested holy orders, no matter how many times his hands reached into skirts or bodices. Alexander was not the type to bow to any god, or to any man. Was it just that he was too good-looking to be a celibate of Moor? His hood was down, and his throat was exposed. She saw the delicate blue vein threading up into his unkempt, still wet beard, and imagined she could detect its pulse by sight. Genevieve licked her lips with a rough tongue. Chapter 8. This was a strange brood, Antonia Marsilac thought to herself, and no mistake. For the millionth time, she wondered whether it wouldn't have been cleverer to stay in Miragliano and throw herself on the mercy of the city's fathers. She'd had nothing to do with Isidro's damned poison water, and suspected he was only taking her away with him to his luxury bolt hole in Britonia, because she knew a lot about the careless way he'd pursued personal profit at the expense of public safety. She should have turned the hog in and petitioned for a reward instead of sticking by him. He was no use anyway, never had been. Even when things were going well, he'd been more interested in the counting house than the bedroom. She should go back to the stage and try to get out of the chorus and into a featured spot. She could act better than some, dance better than most, and the customers always liked to look at her legs. She was still young. She wanted some fun. And here she was, surrounded by refugees from the kind of melodrama the City Fathers had banned from the Miragliano Playhouse as overly morbid and liable to incite public disorder. Before the ban, she'd been in them all, shaking herself during the prologues and getting murdered during the first acts of Brithan Crag's Ystareth, or The Plague Demon and Orfeo's Tall Tale, or The Doom of Zaragoz, Detlef Sieck's The Treachery of Oswald and The Strange History of Dr. Zykiel and Mr. Chaida, Ferring the Balladeer's incredibly violent Brave Conrad and the Skull-Faced Slaughterer, Bruno Malvoisin's obscene Seduced by Slaneshi, or The Baneful Lusts of Diogo Braissac. Those plays had dark and stormy nights, and weary travellers forced to stay the night, and puritanical harridans, and family curses, and secret passages, and much altered wills, and ghouls, goblins, and ghostliness. And here she was, in one again, promoted from the chorus to a featured role. She'd have to watch herself before the first act curtain. The witch, pounding the harpsichord, was competing with the thunder and lightning, while the aunt who hated harlots was foaming at the mouth with righteous hysteria, and the cleric of Renald was sneaking looks at her cleavage whenever he thought he was unobserved. Schedoni seemed courteous enough, but Antonia wasn't convinced he was still alive. She suspected he might be a wired-together corpse used as a ventriloquist's dummy by the scarred butler. She looked around the great hall, wondering where the entrances to the secret passages were. Rovaglioli, the Harridan's husband, was still eating, while everyone else was paying attention to his dark daughter. He was a noisy, messy eater, and food fragments were scattered about his place at the table. Antonia was tired and looking forwards to a big, warm, fresh-laundered bed without Isidro D'Amato in it. They had brought out Estalian's sherry, and it was doing her good inside. Her clothes had dried on her body, and she relished the thought of peeling them off and toweling herself down. Maybe she could find skilled hands to help her with that. Alexander seemed likely enough, and Father Ambrosio would doubtless be keen to volunteer his services. She wasn't that wonderful as a dancer, but she had other skills. She could always find a comfortable place somewhere. She always had. Chocca poured her some more sherry. She was feeling quite tipsy. Rovaglioli scooped a spoonful of some flavoured gruel into his mouth. Antonia wasn't sure whether it was savoury or sweet. He gulped it down with a slurp and reached out for more. Then he paused and his cheeks ballooned as if he had bitten into a whole pepper. His face reddened and the veins in his temples throbbed purple. Tears leaked from his eyes and slipped into the cracks of his swelling cheeks. He slapped the table with both hands, his full spoon splattering gruel around him. Christabel continued to play, but everyone else looked at the suffering man. Rovaglioli held his throat and seemed to be struggling, trying to swallow something.
"What is it?" asked Schedoni.
Rovaglioli shook his head and stood up. His throat apple was bobbing and he was breathing uneasily. His eyes were wide open, bloodshot and panicked.
"It's justice," snarled Flaminea. "That's what it is."
Chocca tried to help the man, holding him upright, giving him a goblet of water. Rovaglioli looked worse than the poisoned plenipotentiary in Sendek Mittal's Lustrian Vengeance, or I Will Eat Their Offal. when he was told that the deathbane-laced tripes he had just eaten were pulled from his beloved grandmother while she was still alive. He pushed the servant away, but poured the water into his mouth, sucking vigorously. He gulped, and the blockage in his throat went down towards his stomach. He drained the rest of the water and reached for the sherry, laughing.
"What was it?" Schedoni asked.
Rovaglioli shrugged and smiled, wiping the spittle off his chin.
"It felt like a metal ball. I've no idea what it was doing in the gruel or what it could have been. It was coated with something sticky."
Then he grabbed his stomach as a spasm hit him.
"It hurts!"
Rovaglioli began shaking, as if lapsing into a fit. He held the edge of the table and grit his teeth.
"Burning inside! It's growing! Hot!"
Suddenly he bent backwards, his spine audibly snapping against the chair rest. His swelling stomach burst through the hooks of his doublet and was exposed. Christabel stopped playing and turned on her stool to look at the commotion her father was causing. Chocker backed away from the flailing man, and several people moved their chairs to give Rovaglioli room. His eyes were showing only white. His stomach was distended like a pregnant woman's about to deliver triplets. Red stretch lines were appearing in the skin. The man was groaning, and there were noises inside him, breaking and tearing noises. Antonia couldn't look away. With a sulphurous bang, Rovaglioli's stomach exploded. Gobbets rained around him, and his chair collapsed. A wisp of blue smoke curled out of the gaping hole in his midriff. Somebody screamed and screamed and screamed. And Antonia realised it was her. Chapter 9. That had been disgusting. Klejowski wiped his sleeve with a napkin and watched everyone panic. D'Amato quieted Antonia down with a slightly overenthusiastic slap, and the dancer sat back, appalled. A bald fellow with bow legs, who'd been sitting near Schedoni, scuttled over, dusty coat tails trailing the floor, and examined the corpse of Signor Ravaglioli, prodding around the edges of his yawning stomach wound with a bony finger. He said.
"This man is dead."
Obviously this was a physician of some insight.
"Some explosive device, I suspect," the doctor added. "Designed to react to the inside of a human stomach."
He took a fork and poked around inside the mess.
"Ah, yes,"
he said, holding up a small, shiny scrap of something.
"Here's a fragment."
"Thank you, Dr. Valdemar," said Schedoni. "Chocker, have this mess cleared away and then bring us coffee."
Klejowski got up and thumped the table. Cutlery rattled. Ambrosio stopped his still full wine goblet from falling over.
"I don't think you understand," he said. "This man is dead. Murdered."
"Yes?" Schedoni seemed puzzled by his outburst.
"Someone must have killed him." "Indubitably."
"Aren't you going to find the murderer, see that he or she is punished?" Jocka and two servants brought an old curtain to carry off Ravaglioli in, and a maid with a bucket and mop appeared to tidy up the quarter of the room that had been splattered. Schedoni shrugged.
"Of course. Murderers are always exposed. Always punished. But first we should finish our meal. The habits of Udolpho will never be disturbed by something as crude as a mere killing."
Everyone at the table appeared to agree with the old man, and so, feeling foolish, Klejowski sat down. Not only was this family the epitome of the parasite classes, they were all mad. Christabel, piqued because her father's death had interrupted her recital, returned to the table and took her seat. Ambrosio made a grasp at her bottom, but she brushed his hand away. Ravaglioli's chair was tipped back, and he was lifted onto the sheet and quickly wrapped. The maid wiped up.
Put him in the cold storage room, Dr. Valdemar instructed the steward. I shall examine further later. There may be much we can learn.
Perhaps our guest might say a blessing for the dead,
suggested Vatek the lawyer. Everyone looked at Klajowski, and he resisted the urge to look behind him. He kept forgetting he was a cleric of Moor. Klajowski mumbled something and made gestures in the air, vaguely trying to imitate clerics he'd seen at funerals. No one questioned his impersonation, and the coffee arrived in several steaming pots.
I must tell old Melmoth,
Vatek said, addressing himself to Schedoni.
This will affect the will. Ravaglioli was in direct line of succession.
No, he wasn't, snapped Flaminea, between thirsty little sips at the boiling black coffee. I was.
Vatek scratched his bristle-covered cheek.
My late husband married into Udolpho. I am the direct heir, am I not, father?
Schedoni shook his head, as if unable to remember.
I thought father was grandfather's son, said Christabel, and that you, mother, married into the family.
That was my impression, said the lawyer.
Well, your impression was wrong, snarled Flaminea. I have always been the heir. Father Ambrosio will confirm the truth, won't you, uncle?
Ambrosio, who was dividing his attention between Antonia's thighs and Christabel's breasts, applied himself to the question.
I'm not your uncle, said the father. I'm your father. Before I entered the cult of Renald, I was married to my cousin, Clarimonde. She was abducted by the banditti and never heard from again, but she left me with a daughter.
Ambrosio's hand had dipped below the table in Christabel's direction. He winced and brought it up again. Christabel still had her meat fork.
Uncle, you are confused, said Flaminea. You are a father, not my father. Surely you concede that Christabel is your grandniece, not your granddaughter.
Ambrosio drank his coffee, the prong marks red against the white skin of his hand, and said, reasonably,
I believe Christabel is Pintaldi's sister, is she not?
Christabel?
Said Flaminea, eyes glowing blue. The dark girl shook her head and said,
It's nothing to me.
Outside, the thunder had receded to a dull rumble every few minutes, and the main noise was the steady tattoo of the rain against the walls and the rattling of the windows. Inside, Klajowski's head was beginning to ache.
More coffee?
Asked Schedoni, courteously. Chapter 10. She had lost track of time and could not tell how many years she'd been imprisoned. Her life before she came to Udolpho was a distant, vague memory. She had been married, she thought, and had children. She had lived in a city near the sea, and her husband had been a mariner, eventually the owner of his own boat, his own shipping line. Then she'd travelled, and come, during one of these damnable thunderstorms, to Udolpho. Her captors called her Matilda, but that wasn't her name. Her real name was Matilda. No, it was... she couldn't remember. Chocca, the tall man with the twisted face who brought her her meals, could not speak. But he was often accompanied by a bent, mad old man named Schedoni, and he always called her Matilda. He spoke to her as if she was pitiably altered, but there was nothing wrong with her. She was not a victim of warpstone. She was a normal woman. She tried to lift her head, but the weights Chocca fastened around her skull while she was asleep were too heavy. There had been a slit window once, but it had been bricked up. She could never tell whether it was day or night, but she knew when there was a storm. She could hear the thunder, and the stones of the ceiling would become wet, occasionally dripping on her. She didn't know why she was held prisoner. At first, she'd begged for her release, then for an explanation. Now, she didn't bother. They called her Matilda and were sorry for her, but they'd never let her free. she would die in this room and be buried under a slab carved with the name of Matilda Udolpho. That was to be her fate. Once she had secreted a chicken bone from one of her meals and snapped it, making a sharp tool. For months she'd scraped away at the mortar between the stones, loosening large blocks. She'd rested her head against the cold wall while she worked away with her bone trowel and had flattened a part of her face. In the end, Chokka had caught her. She had tried to sever the vein in his throat with the sharp bone, but it had just broken on his skin. He didn't abuse her for her attack, but she'd eaten filleted meat and fowl ever since. She tried to remember her real husband, her real family, but she could only picture the face of Shedoni Udolpho and recall the names of the children he repeatedly told her they'd had together. Montoni, Ambrosio, Flaminea. She tried to stand but couldn't. Her head was heavy as a cannonball and her neck had long since withered away. She could draw her knees up and crouch, but her head stayed anchored to the floor. She dragged herself, pulling with her hands and pushing with her feet across the floor of the room, the carpet bunching up under her. One day, Matilda would get out, and then they'd all be sorry. Chapter 11. Chokka stopped and grunted, tapping D'Amato on the chest. The water merchant staggered back as if he'd been dealt a weighty blow. The huge steward pushed open a door. It creaked, of course. Chokka shoved D'Amato through it. Then he lifted up his candle and proceeded down the corridor. Klojowski didn't know where they were within the house. They had been led a long way away from the great hall, through passages and up staircases. They could be either deep in the depths of Udolpho or high up in one of the towers. They had passed through a derelict part of the building, and he had imagined that Chokka was a little afraid, casting too many careful looks about him, flinching away from the holes in the walls and the screened-off rooms. Klojowski hated to think what might put a fright into the giant brute. These were the guest apartments. Antonia was trying to smile and talking to the steward, asking him questions about the family and about the house. Chokka interjected a few groans into his grunts. "This reminds me very much," the dancer was saying, "of the demon-blighted inn of Von Diels, The Fate of Fair Florence, or Tortured and Abandoned." They came to another door, and Chokka pushed it open. There was a fire burning in a grate in the room beyond, which was decorated in the Cathayan style, with silks and low tables and pieces of porcelain. The steward pointed a finger at Antonia. "For me," she said. "Thank you. It looks lovely. Very homey." Klojowski was in the room next door, a tiny cell with a bare cot, a single candle, and a thin blanket. This was what they thought fitting for a cleric, obviously. Next time he was forced to take a disguise, he'd pick something likely to win him better accommodation. Chokka slammed the door behind him, and he was alone. There was a thin window, and the rain steadily spattered against it. Klojowski peered through, but couldn't see anything beyond the trickles of water. He stripped off his habit and got out of the novice's boots. His feet were still filthy from the forest mud. The rest of his clothes were ragged and grimy from his spell in the dungeons of Zalucho. He undressed, tearing his breeches to pieces and unpicking the rags of his shirt from his chest and arms. There was a basin of water by his bedside. He remembered D'Amato's yellow ague, but assumed that up here in the mountains they wouldn't be buying from a bloodsucker like him. Obviously, they had enough rain to fill their own butts. He washed himself thoroughly and felt better than he had done in months. Oddly, there was a full-length mirror in the room, the one non-ascetic touch of the furnishing. He stood naked before it and held up the candle. The dungeon hadn't been good for him. There were bruises on his wrists, ankles, back and chest, and he had scabbed over wounds on his knees and hips. He could see his bones too clearly through his skin, and his face was more haggard than romantically gaunt. Still, that particular ordeal was over. Then his image in the mirror shook and distorted, as if a ripple were travelling across a still pond. The frame lurched forwards, and the mirror swung open like a door. Klejowski tried to cover himself with a towel. His heart beat too fast. Something came out of the dark space behind the mirror and seized him by the neck, pulling his head down. Chapter 12. There was nothing for it but to do the deed herself. Vatek was too spineless for the business, and in any case, she would never have trusted him to carry it through. In the months since she had first seduced the lawyer, Cristobal Udolpho had learned many things. She knew now that there was not one will, but many different, mutually irreconcilable wills. Old Melmoth Udolpho changed his mind daily and insisted on newly drafted testaments. Some he would sign, some he would abandon. She dressed carefully, in tight riding breeches and a loose blouse, then pulled on her soft leather boots and spent some time braiding her hair. Vatek watched her, chattering about nothing, going over and over the plan. He was confused about the details, but she had them down cold. The lawyer touched her neck and let his thin fingers creep into her hair. She felt a thrill of disgust, but suppressed it and gave him a winsome smile in the mirror. Vatek was a vile creature, hirsute all over his body and given to sweating. There was some animal in his soul, she was sure, a pig or a bear, but he wasn't strong, not in his limbs or in his mind. He was easy to lead. Christabel touched the furred back of Vatek's hand and rubbed her cheek against his arm. Soon it would all be over. Soon all the fortune of Udolpho would be hers. Then she could take lovers for herself, gratify her own wants. Alexandre, the cleric of Moor, had seemed interesting in a reedy, sly sort of way. And she'd heard the maids talking about the giant, Odo Choka, and how his manly parts were in proportion to the rest of him. A tiny flare of desire raised her hackles. Her hair crackled with electricity and expanded a little, giving Vatek a slight shock. He withdrew his hand and tried to laugh.
"Be sure to finish him," he said. "You must be sure."
Christabel smiled as she pulled the Falconer's gloves on. They were fine leather and felt good on her hands. She had strong hands, from hours of practice with harpsichord and duelling sword. After the fortune was disposed of and the Black Signet's treasure found, she would have to turn her attention to lawyer Vatek. Perhaps an accident might be arranged, a fall from the south wall, an encounter with wolves. She stood up. She was taller than the lawyer, and he had to look up to meet her eyes. His smile was shaking. He was afraid of what they were about to do. Afraid of her. She patted his shoulders. He had dictated the final will, naming herself sole heir to the house and fortunes of the family. Old Melmoth, the blind fool, had signed it, imagining himself to be dealing with a minor business matter. All the other wills were bundled up in scrolls in Vatek's office, waiting to be burned. Melmoth could not live much longer, not without Valdemar's infusions to keep him going. Christabel opened a drawer and pulled out a ball of copper wire. It was supposed to be for the harpsichord. She unravelled a length and held it up before Vatek's face. His eyes wavered. She bit through the wire and held up a loop of about 4 feet, the ends tied around her thick gloved hands. She pulled the loop tight, and it straightened with a musical twang. It would do the job. "I'll be back," she told Vatek, and stepped out into the dark hallway, moving silently through the gloom towards the doctor's rooms. Very soon she would be very rich, and then they'd all tremble. Chapter 13. At least the last surprise had been relatively pleasant.
I knew there'd be a secret door somewhere.
They were cramped on his cot, but after weeks in a dungeon, Klejowski was not about to complain. Antonia was soft and expert. Being a dancer gave her a lot of control. She wore bells on her anklets, and they had tinkled amusingly as her legs wrapped around him, ankles crossed tight against the small of his back. His neck was cricked as his head was propped against the headboard, but the enjoyable warmth of Antonia's body pressed close to his own made up for that.
I searched my room and found some levers by the fire. I didn't want to be alone in this place.
Klejowski wondered if Antonia would be a convert to the cause. She evidently had an attachment to that bloated bourgeois exploiter, D'Amato, but it could hardly be very strong. After all, she'd sought out his company.
You're not really a cleric, are you?
He admitted it. She snuggled closer, settling her head on his chest.
I knew it. No one is what they say they are.
Are you really a dancer?
And an actress. Not now, I admit, but I was. The City Fathers closed down the Miragliano Playhouse, and I had to find something to do. And there was Isidro lolling about in the street with his purse clinking.
What about D'Amato? Is he what he says he is? She pouted.
He's running away from the City Fathers. The yellow ague is his fault. He poisoned everyone.
He had been right about the water merchant.
Coins are all he cares about, Alexander. Coins and the things they can buy. Things like houses and horses and clothes and statues. Things like me.
She rubbed a warm knee up his leg, exciting him again.
Don't worry, she said. This is compliments of the management. Selling it never got me anywhere but into trouble. Even dancing is better than that. Isidro took me to a municipal ball once. Before everyone started foaming yellow and dying, and all the City Fathers' wives ignored me, there was this one woman, Donna Elena, who was a real cow, and made jokes behind her fan that set all her hen friends off on that horrible pretend laughing. I wanted to kill them all, scratch their eyes out. Donna Elena's husband, Don Lucio, was a commissioner of public works. Isidro wanted him to grant him a city contract to provide water for the watch stations. After the ball, Isidro told me to go to a waterfront inn with Don Lucio and let him do what he wanted.
Did you enjoy it?
Not it itself. There wasn't much to Don Lucio, if you get my meaning. But I kept thinking of Donna Elena and her fan and her laugh. She'd sold it too, but for life. And I was only stuck with Don Lucio for the night. She had him forever. And good luck to her too, the slag.
There's injustice in the world, my love.
Too bloody true, she said, rolling on top of him, flicking his neck with her tongue. But forget that for now.
He did. Chapter 14. Genevieve couldn't sleep. She only really felt alive at night. In her nightgown, she paced her room, listening to the noises of the night. There were creatures in the storm calling to her. Her room was modest. She had no mirrors. Above her mantel was a portrait of Flamineo, her father. He had looked much like Flaminea, his twin, but had been wild where she was puritanical. A flash of lightning lit up her father's face, making his eyes glow blue. He was painted standing on the mountainside, with the silhouette of Udolpho in the background and tall trees all around. Sometimes people imagined they saw things moving in the trees in the picture, bright-eyed and sharp-clawed things. Her father had been a huntsman, an associate of that famous devotee of the chase, Graf Rudiger von Unheimlich. He had died of a fall during a hog course. He had been obsessed with dangerous game, and had even been known to set out after creatures with near-human intelligence. Werewolves, goblins, elementals. No wonder he was dead. Genevieve couldn't remember him. He had the Udolpho face, but so did everyone else she knew. There was more lightning. She looked at the portrait, and it was a landscape. The trees were there, and the hillside, and the silhouette. But her father was missing. It had happened before. Chapter 15. Her strangling wire before her, she crept down the passage. Vatek had told her these were the corridors haunted by the bleeding Baron, a houseguest of Smara Udolpho, who had been stabbed by his sons but refused to die. She kept to the shadows, trying to stay silent. Christabel thought of what she'd do with the fortune when it came to her. First, she would expel her relatives from Udolpho and cut them loose in the world. They wouldn't last a month apiece. Then she'd dismantle the house stone by stone until she had the Black Signet's treasure. Then, the wealthiest woman in the known world, she would return to the great cities of the Empire, of Britonia, of Kislev, and make all men her slaves. Countries were hers for the taking. She heard something and pressed herself into an alcove, blending with the dark. Something heavy was coming down the passage. She held her breath and waited. Heavy footsteps sounded out, but there was a metallic creaking. Blue light filtered through from somewhere. Christabel tried to shrink into a ball, her killing loop ready just in case. A man-shaped thing rounded the corner. It was taller than Chocker by a full 3 feet and had to bend its head to fit into the high-ceilinged passage. The apparition was clad in a full set of antique armour. It was burnished iron, with fiery designs inlaid, and moved like an animated statue. It had a species of clanky grace that was almost bewitching. Christabel stood up and was ignored as the thing walked past. Vatek had not told her about any mailed monster. This was a new addition to the histories of Udolpho. The armoured giant moved slowly, but with purpose. Its visor was down, but there was a blue glow behind the slits. Not knowing why, she stepped out into the thing's path and looked up at it.